This is VOA News via remote. I'm Liz Peltz. U.S. President Joe Biden moved on several actions to undo his predecessor's legacy during his first few days in office. The president halted construction of the U.S.-Mexico border wall, rejoined the World Health Organization and the Paris Climate Accord, and bolstered the means for production of COVID-19 vaccines. But the executive orders pale in comparison to the $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief package that he requested from Congress. In an interview with ABC's This Week, Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar says she's optimistic about President Biden's COVID-19 relief bill.
We're in charge, and with even votes, we should be able to get legislation to the floor, including the pandemic relief package. As for the amount that Joe Biden has proposed, that's exactly the numbers we were talking about last summer. And at some point, the administration was talking those numbers.
Just two cabinet nominees were confirmed by week's end, much to the frustration of the Biden White House. Russia says it is willing and ready to set up a dialogue with the U.S.'s new Biden administration. A Kremlin spokesman said Sunday differences are expected to be aired, adding that President Vladimir Putin would respond in kind to U.S. willingness to talk. Moscow and Washington relations have been at their lowest since the end of the Cold War. The two sides are at odds over Russia's role in Ukraine and allegations of its meddling in the U.S. elections, which it denies, among many other issues. The U.S. also called on Russian authorities to release protesters and journalists detained at demonstrations supporting detained Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny on Saturday. You can read more about it on voanews.com. This is VOA News. Yemen's Houthi group and Saudi-backed government began UN-backed negotiations on a prisoner exchange Sunday. That's according to United Nations and Yemeni officials. The two sides have been at war for almost 6 years. The meeting in Jordan comes days after the United States designated the Iran-aligned Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization. It's a move the United Nations had warned could undermine peace efforts and worsen Yemen's humanitarian crisis. A UN-chartered plane carried four Houthi officials from Sana'a to Amman on Saturday. The talks aimed to free 300 prisoners, including high-ranking officials like the brother of President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, whose internationally recognized government was ousted by the Houthis, sources familiar with the matter said. Twin attacks overnight on the army in central Mali killed six soldiers. The military said 30 suspected jihadists were also left dead in response. The attacks occurred near the border with Burkina Faso at army positions that have been targeted in the past. A deadly Islamist offensive having begun in northern Mali in 2012 before spreading elsewhere. The raids happened at Burkesi and Mondoro in the violence-racked center of the Sahel country. About 40 motorcycles and a large amount of military gear were seized from the attackers, according to the army. On Thursday, three other Malian soldiers were killed in a bomb blast in the Mondoro area. India has donated millions of doses of the British-developed AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine to neighboring South Asian nations. It's an unusual diplomatic initiative that analysts say aims to raise New Delhi's global profile and push back against China, which has been expanding its influence in South Asia. As the world's largest vaccine producer, India is set to be at the forefront of supplying affordable shots against COVID-19 to low- and middle-income countries. Shipments of the vaccine landed in recent days in Bhutan, Nepal, Bangladesh, Maldives, Myanmar, Mauritius, and Seychelles, just days after India launched its own nationwide inoculation program. China reported 80 new COVID-19 cases on Saturday. That's down from 107 reported on Friday. The cases were mostly in the Northeast, where some residents complained of food shortage amid ongoing lockdowns. Portugal voters headed to the polls on Sunday, masked, socially distanced, and given their own pens to avoid spreading the coronavirus. They were voting largely for the ceremonial post of president. Via remote, I'm Liz Pelka, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On January 20, 2021, Democrat Joseph R. Biden Jr. was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States of America.
The will of the people has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
With those words, U.S. President Joe Biden conjured the act that shocked the world and almost jeopardized the democracy of which Mr. Biden spoke. On January 6th, just 2 weeks before Inauguration Day, the U.S. Capitol was stormed by protesters bent on disrupting a joint session of Congress's normally ceremonial task of counting the Electoral College votes that certified Joe Biden as the winner of the presidential election. The House of Representatives blamed former President Donald Trump for instigating the deadly mob attack. Donald Trump was impeached by the House on the charge of inciting insurrection. In a break with historic norms and customs, outgoing President Trump did not attend the inauguration of his successor, nor did he and former First Lady Melania Trump receive the Bidens at the White House before departing Washington for Florida. As VOA's Ken Bredemeyer reports, Joe Biden at 78 is the country's oldest leader ever and is no stranger to public service. He served 36 years as a U.S. senator and 8 as vice president. In his inaugural address, Mr. Biden underscored the stakes that America faces in the coming days under his leadership.
We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity, the sting of systemic racism, a climate in crisis, America's role in the world.
Speaking of America's role in the world, he went on to say,
so here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. We'll be a strong and trusted partner for peace, progress, and security.
On Inauguration Day, Kamala Harris, a former senator from California of Black and South Asian descent, was sworn in as vice president, becoming the highest-ranking female official in more than two centuries of U.S. history. Her rise to the second in command stirred pride in women and girls around the United States. The question facing America is, will President Biden's message of unity penetrate and resonate with the millions of Americans who did not vote for him in a nation which remains deeply polarized?
Disagreement must not lead to disunion. And I pledge this to you. I will be a president for all Americans, all Americans. And I promise you, I will fight as hard for those who did not support me as for those who did.
On his first day on the job, President Biden signed a raft of executive orders, reversing his predecessor's agenda on the environment, the economy, and immigration. He authorized the United States' re-entry into the Paris Climate Accords and the World Health Organization, rescinded the so-called Muslim ban, and halted construction of Mr. Trump's border wall with Mexico, among many others. For more on the transfer of power and the domestic and international ramifications of Joe Biden as the 46th president of the United States, we turn to two seasoned political analysts. Elaine Kmark is senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, a policy group here in Washington. And Frances Lee, she's professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University. She's also the co-author of the recently published book, The Limits of Party, Congress, and Lawmaking in a Polarized Era. And both women were recently featured on our sister program, Press Conference USA. And both ladies join me via Microsoft Teams. Elaine, first to you. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for having me back.
And Francis, we're so glad to have you back as well.
It's great to be here. Thank you, Carol.
Elaine Kmark, without further ado, let me get your reaction to the inauguration, the tone and the substance.
Well, it was unfortunate that we came to this point in this country where we had to have 25,000 armed guards to hold an inauguration. On the other hand, there were no disturbances. There were no demonstrators. Nobody came at them with guns. I mean, whatever insurrection was waged on January 6th seems to have either fallen apart or gone back to think of something else to do. And there was no attack on the Capitol. Now, that's probably due to the fact that there were so many armed guards there. And it's probably due to the fact that over 100 people have been charged with crimes since then. And I think there were a lot of people on January 6th who somehow thought that they could do this, that because they were doing it at the behest of Donald Trump, that there would be no consequences, and have now discovered that they're under arrest. And sometimes they're under arrest for some very serious federal crimes. So I think the combination of all the soldiers there and the consequences have taken the steam out of this movement, at least for the time being. As to the inauguration itself, frankly, it was beautiful. You know, it was beautifully done. I think because there weren't crowds there, everyone went out of their way to pay special attention to the visuals there. And, you know, the mall was covered with flags. There were beautiful scenes and programming from the Lincoln Memorial. Frankly, it was quite lovely as a television spectacle. And my guess is that between the inauguration and between the very successful Democratic convention, we may see more and more of these large-scale virtual events in the future. They may be one of the lasting legacies of the pandemic.
Let me turn to you, Francis, for your take on both the tone and the substance of this historic event.
So Elaine certainly gave us a good picture of the setting, the remarkable setting in which the inauguration took place. It also points to thematically, it was very coherent. Everything about the inauguration, all the remarks, beginning with the opening prayer and including the poem recited, focused on the need for unity and the possibility of unity. As the president put it in his address, it doesn't have to be a unity forged around agreement. That wouldn't be unrealistic. Instead, it's a unity forged around mutual respect. Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire. That's a path forward. And Biden, with his long years of experience working in the Senate, a body that functions, when it functions at all, in a bipartisan manner, knows how to engage in debate with adversaries, a productive debate to advance policy. So certainly out of that experience, you know, he can testify to the possibility of moving ahead on policy despite polarization. It's also worth pointing out that there's a track record already established in doing that, even as recently as last year, in the midst of, you know, the toxic partisanship of a presidential campaign immediately on the heels of a presidential impeachment trial in the Senate. You get the passage of the CARES Act, remarkably sweeping legislation, really nothing like it in U.S. history, $2.2 trillion aimed at addressing the economic consequences of the pandemic and also in preparing the health system to respond to it. Followed this December during a crisis where the outgoing president does not concede the election. Congress passed a $900 billion package to deal with the issues, you know, stemming from the pandemic. So Congress has been able to reach bipartisan agreement on major issues, even in the context of the difficulties that we faced in the waning years of the Trump administration. So setting a tone of more cooperation and respect ought to advance it further.
In the second half of the program, we'll get into these legislative challenges more. But before we do, back to you, Elaine Kmark, because I want to continue on a bit about the fact that former President Trump never formally conceded the election, the fact that he did not participate in what are considered the ceremonial niceties of receiving the Bidens at the White House, of attending the inauguration, and the fact that he did not renounce what analysts say is, quote, the big lie, that he did not lose the election, that he actually won and that there was widespread fraud. How concerned are you that this narrative might continue, particularly among his supporters? One more thing, I was watching some of the news channels that are very pro-Trump, and in some cases they weren't showing President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris, but were showing Mr. Trump's farewell address over and over again.
First of all, Trump is a sore loser. We could have predicted this from everything he's said prior to this. Losing is maybe the worst thing that he can possibly imagine happening to him. He has always gotten his way in life. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, as we say, and he has bullied his way to yes in every aspect of life, whether it was women that he forced sexually, whether it was business deals where he sued and sued and sued and didn't pay his contractors. I mean, he has been a bully who is not used to being told no. And it was no surprise to anybody that he reacted this way when it came to losing the presidential election. Listen, I mean, some of us were pleased that, you know, you didn't have to have the Secret Service go into the White House itself and pull the guy out. That's how bad he's been. So this is not a surprise given who he was. The surprise is that the Republican Party could nominate a person like this to begin with. And I think a lot of people are now evaluating whether or not that was such a good move. So I think that he is who he is, and we've always known that, but some people chose to look the other way. Now, the big lasting problem that he leaves is this problem of trust in government. People now are extraordinarily skeptical of, you know, what elected officials say and of our democratic system of governance, even though you can probably argue that this was one of the most secure elections we've ever had. And the reason is it started before the pandemic. It started with the Russian interference in 2016. And after that, states made concerted efforts to harden their election infrastructure. Ironically, and here's an interesting little fact, the efforts to secure the infrastructure, there were a bunch of things to do that. One of them was to get paper ballots as a backup to ballots in the machines. And that's because before the pandemic, we were most worried in election security about hacking into voting machines. And we thought, well, having a paper trail would make a recount easier and more secure. Well, lo and behold, the pandemic comes along and people decide they want to vote by mail. And guess what we've got? We've got an election with an enormous number of paper ballots in it, making it very easy to do a recount. So we had several recounts in contested states. We had lots of court cases. All of them went against Donald Trump. And yet he continued, even having exhausted all his legal remedies, he continued to argue that he had somehow won the election. And I think this is going to leave us with a big, big problem, because what do? You tear your hair out, say there's no evidence, you exhausted every legal remedy and you lost, and yet some people are still going to believe him.
Yeah, and let me just pick up quickly in the interest of time. Not only that, Elaine, but it's also the many, more than 100 members of Congress and senators who literally, while the mob was attacking the Capitol, were voting and did so after the attack to object to President Biden's Electoral College vote certification. So over to you, Francis Lee. Others are concerned primarily about what President Biden said in his address, the assault on truth. It seems like Americans don't have a common set of facts, and that's perhaps the sad legacy of former President Trump. How do you see that going forward and our ability to, in fact, forge unity that President Biden wants to do when you still have people clinging to false narratives?
Well, the signals that we have seen coming out of Congress on that question are unclear. When the Senate was asked to vote on the certification of the electoral slates from the states, they opted to do so. Almost all Republicans voted to do so. In the House of Representatives, however, different story. In the two contested states considered in the vote count on January 6th, the night of January 6th, most Republicans voted against the certification of the electoral states from Arizona and Pennsylvania. So that to me suggests that it's still an open question going forward as to how Republicans will portray the 2020 election to their voters. It's clear that Republicans in the electorate will listen to Republican office holders. They listened to President Trump when he said that the election was a fraud. And most polls show that most Republicans in the electorate believed President Trump when he said that. Will members of Congress, Republican members, continue to press those claims or not? And the signals we got coming out of the House and the Senate diverged in that respect. So I think it's unclear at this juncture what the future holds. But I think it matters a great deal what happens going forward, that this is in motion, and that, you know, if the legitimacy of President Biden is continually called into question, that's a different politics than if members of Congress treat the question as having been settled by the electoral vote count that occurred.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Elaine Kmark. She's senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program and director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, and Frances Lee, from whom you just heard. She's professor of politics and public affairs at Princeton University. We're discussing the transition of power in Washington as Joe Biden is inaugurated as the 46th president of the United States. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a faithful fan in Africa, Augustine Ando. And as always, if you want to hear your name and even home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Elaine Kmark. Let's go to the other major challenges of President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris as the tiebreaker in the Senate. Should legislation come to the floor and need her to break a tie in the Senate, because there's a 50-50 split between Republicans and Democrats, but Democrats are in control of the Senate, Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and now Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. How do you see the ability to get this almost $1.9 trillion COVID relief legislation through that President Biden would like to pass? Other major issues, immigration reform, for example.
Well, I think that it's tough because there's no margin in the Senate and there's a very small margin in the House. So we have to take that into consideration, too. On the other hand, if anyone can do it, it's probably Joe Biden. And the reason is he's the first president we've had in a long time with this depth of experience in the United States Senate. He was there 36 years. He knows an awful lot of these people, and they've been through an awful lot. So that still may not make a difference. I mean, the country is very polarized, and the Senate and the House are very polarized. But Biden's first instinct is to make a deal, to get into the Senate and to try to come up with a bipartisan deal. What we've seen is the president signing a bunch of executive orders that undid Trump's executive orders. And this is obviously pretty short term. I mean, one president comes in, signs a bunch of executive orders. The next president comes in 4 years later, unsigns all those executive orders. That's not the way to create lasting and substantive change.
So turning over to you, Frances, this is your area of expertise. We talked about it the last time when you were on the program, the ability to pass legislation in a bipartisan way. Do you agree with Elaine that the depth of President Biden's experience in the Senate, his personal relationships, that that could make a difference given the split control and the very small majority that the Democrats hold? How do you see that in addition to the fact that we are likely to see an impeachment trial in the Senate of former President Donald Trump?
Absolutely. I agree with Elaine's characterization. I think that Biden's long experience has taught him how Washington policymaking works. And he understands that bipartisanship is necessary for congressional action. He, in fact, was quite frank with Democratic activists on the campaign trail in the lead up to the election. They needed to confront that fact that bipartisanship is how things get done. And without bipartisanship, he said, all you have is abuse of power by the executive. So he knows that this is what's necessary. It's somewhat ironic that the outcome of the Georgia Senate races while giving Democrats more power to approve the president's nominees, in some ways will make his job of party management more difficult, because the Democratic base will expect him to deliver more now and to do things on a party line basis that was not possible for them to do if Democrats had not won control of the Senate. So there will be pressure. There's pressure on Schumer as Democratic leader in the Senate to do away with the filibuster and pass the Democrats' wish list without any Republican support. Biden will resist that impulse, but he has to manage those expectations in a way that he would not have needed to do had the Georgia Senate races gone the other way.
Back to you, Elaine. I want to pick up on that because that's a very interesting point. Conversely, do you think there'll be some pressure on the so-called moderates in the Senate not to maybe cooperate with the Democrats? I'm talking about people like Republican Senators Susan Collins of Maine or Mitt Romney of Utah. Will they be discouraged by now Minority Leader Mitch McConnell? How do you see it?
Well, I think that given a closely divided Senate, there's a bunch of senators, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side, who are very much in the catbird seat, who very much can control the outcome. So on the Democratic side, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, he can't always be counted to be in lockstep with the rest of the Democrats. So Biden's going to have to worry about losing Manchin's vote on things, just as McConnell has to worry about losing Mitt Romney's vote or Susan Collins's vote. So when you've got a Senate that's a 50-50 Senate, basically, this is tough. And I think that Kamala Harris, the new vice president, is going to be very busy. I think she's going to spend a lot more time than she thought she would in the vice president's office in the Senate, breaking ties.
Quickly on impeachment, Elaine, how do you think that's going to go forward, the impeachment trial?
This is very interesting. The longer we look into the January 6th insurrection, the worse it looks. It does look like this was not a demonstration that got out of control. It is beginning to look like something that was actually planned. There was reconnaissance. There was a command and control structure. This looks worse and worse by day. Many of us are wondering if Senator Mitch McConnell's openness to convicting President Trump, who he was in lockstep with for the last 4 years, might be due to the kinds of intelligence he's receiving about what happened in the Senate.
Do you think that there's a possibility, Francis Lee, this time around, of a conviction of former President Trump, whether on the merits, as well as maybe for political reasons, because some Republicans would like to see him out of the picture because he could also be barred from running again if he were, in fact, convicted?
Yes, I agree. It is possible that the Senate will opt to convict. It's an open question, certainly much more so than the last impeachment trial last year in February of 2020. But this matter won't be decided merely on the merits, because this is also a question for the future of the Republican Party and whether they want to leave open the possibility that the former President Trump could run again, whether he continues to be the leader of the Republican Party out of power or not. If he is convicted, then that takes him out of the game. I mean, it would not be difficult. Only a majority vote would then be necessary in the Senate to bar him from running again. So it's a question of what the party wants for itself, as well as a question on the merits of the impeachment case itself. And I wonder how the party views that question. No Republican candidate nationally has been as effective at getting out the Republican vote as President Trump. He was remarkable in his ability to reach voters who, you know, don't reliably turn out for the party. So that's a great asset to the party, and it's not clear they can replace that. On the other hand, certainly after the events of January 6th, it may be that certain key stakeholders in the Republican Party may regard him as an agent of chaos.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Elaine Kmark, Director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, and Francis Lee, Professor of Politics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Ladies, thanks so much for your terrific observations.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you, Carol.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. First, the education report. Dan Friedel talks about how the pandemic is affecting the college application process. Then Alice Bryant gives us a report on the vaccine efforts in Africa. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with the making of a nation. But first, the education report.
One of the most important parts of a college application is a student's list of extracurricular activities. A student might be a member of a sports team, spend time tutoring younger children, or taking part in a school's theater program or singing group. Some students might do all of those things. Usually at this time, American high school students are finishing their college applications. They are also visiting universities and taking admissions tests like the SAT. But this is not most years. Since most people are not traveling, students are taking video campus tours. Universities that used to talk to possible students in person are doing so by video call instead. Along with written applications, universities are asking students to send video introductions. Some schools asked students to write about how the pandemic changed their lives. One student whose life is different over the last 10 months is 18-year-old Kiddist Bekele. She grew up in Ethiopia, but now lives in Annandale, Virginia, near Washington, D.C. On her application, she wrote about what it was like coming to America in ninth grade. Bekele said she wants to be an engineer and is hoping to go to a university that offers good science classes. She said, attending school over video most of the last year has been hard, especially in science and math classes that require a lot of help from teachers. She also missed the support of adults at her school who could help with college applications. Completing her application at home was not easy. Laura Wells is one of the Annandale High School advisors who works with students like Bekele on their college applications. In most years, the process begins 1 year before students complete high school. They start writing their essays in 11th grade. Then the next year, they only have to prepare the application. Wells and her students are hurrying to finish some parts of their applications this year. In October, Wells said, she put her own children to bed and then spent the rest of the night making video calls with her students so she could help with their applications. She said, it is much easier to do work on an application in person than on a video call. Many students Wells works with have parents who are not U.S. citizens. They are immigrants and have a permanent resident card, sometimes known as a green card. As a result, the teenagers need to provide additional documents to include with their application. Sometimes they have to take an extra test to prove they can speak English well enough. The questions are so confusing, Wells said. The pandemic made it hard to complete the applications, and Wells said it limited opportunities for younger students who wanted to try new activities. Students are still trying to improve their standing, even without traditional resume builders. Wells said one group worked on a project for Amnesty International. Another organized an effort to send reading materials to students in Africa. Bekele said she and her friends from East Africa organized an Ethiopian and Eritrean association and held meetings online. Wells said even if students are not able to join clubs or get involved in group activities, there are still ways to show American colleges their abilities. Students can take a free online class from a U.S. university in a subject that they could not take at their own school. They can do these classes in their free time. Extra activities can make a difference to the people who consider applications. The pandemic also made colleges and universities worried about how many students to accept. Some students are putting off college until a vaccine is available. As a result, many small colleges are worried they may not have enough students. Those colleges are making it easier for students to apply and to be accepted. Other universities that are difficult to get into, like Harvard, are worried that they may have too many students. Last year, some students who were accepted decided to wait a year. This year, Harvard offered acceptance to only about 7% of early applicants. I'm Dan Friedel.
Now, here is Alice Bryant.
Many African countries are expected to receive their first COVID-19 vaccine doses in March from the United Nations COVAX effort. The World Health Organization's Africa director recently announced the plan. The statement comes as deaths on the continent from the disease have been rising. COVAX is a plan from the WHO, the European Commission, and France to vaccinate people in poor and middle-income countries against COVID-19. Matsidiso Moeti is the WHO Regional Director for Africa. She told reporters that a larger supply of the millions of doses from COVAX is expected by June. It is the second major vaccine announcement in 1 week for the African continent of 1.3 billion people. Last Wednesday, the leader of the African Union said 270 million doses came from Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, and AstraZeneca through the Serum Institute of India. About 600 million doses are expected to be provided through the COVAX effort. Doses are expected to be given to countries based on population size and the severity of their health crises. Health workers will receive the doses first, as thousands of them have been infected. African countries are now recording about 30,000 new virus cases each day, compared to 18,000 during the first surge months ago. John Nkenga Song is director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or Africa CDC. He said that confirmed deaths from COVID-19 jumped 21% in 1 week in Africa, with more than 5,400 reported. This second wave of infections is hitting very, very hard, said Nkenga Song. South Africa is one of the world's hardest hit countries. A highly infectious variant of the virus now makes up most new cases. The country has more than 1.2 million cases, including 35,000 deaths. The WHO's Moeti said gene sequencing tests have found the new variant in three other countries, Botswana, Gambia, and Zambia. Africa CDC Director Nkenga Song said the fast-growing number of cases means we run into short supplies of oxygen. He has been seeking to increase the supply to Africa, where medical oxygen is not easy to get. Vaccine doses from the COVAX effort are expected to reach 20% of the population in Africa. Officials are pushing to secure enough doses to meet the goal of vaccinating the 60% needed to achieve herd immunity against the virus. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore everyday words and expressions. We give examples on how to use them, and sometimes we give you the origin, where the expression comes from. Today we are going to talk about a very small, sharp, and useful object, a pin. We use pins when we sew clothes. We also use pins in some art projects. And we use pins to attach things to our clothing. The sharp point easily goes right through most kinds of cloth. And pin gives us our expression for today, to pin your hopes on something. If you pin your hopes on something, you hope very much that it will help you succeed. You attach your hopes to it. When we pin our hopes on something, we really want it to happen. It can also mean to have expectations connected to the success or performance of a person or thing. For example, a friend of mine really wanted to attend a well-known college, but the tuition cost a lot, and she did not have much money. So she pinned her hopes on winning a scholarship. When the scholarship fell through, she was pretty upset. On the same day, she got more bad news. A very old and very distant uncle had died. It was sad news, but there was a silver lining. You might ask, what good could come from that? Well, this uncle left her a lot of money.
Some word experts say the expression dates from the 1500s. It may have come from soldiers pinning their leader's insignia on their sleeves. This showed where they belonged and who they supported. By the 1800s, however, it took on its current meaning. Here is an example. Listen to these two friends talk about saving money for the future.
So, how much money have you saved so far? You know, for your retirement.
None, but I play the lottery every day.
I don't think it's a good life plan to pin all your hopes on winning the lottery.
You're right. I should have a plan B. I know I will get on a game show and win a lot of money.
I think you should talk to an expert.
There are game show experts?
No, I mean a financial planner.
Oh, that kind of expert.
Yeah, it is not a good idea to pin your financial hopes on a lottery. And in life, it is probably not a good idea to pin all your hopes and dreams on other people. Instead, pin your hopes on you and what you can do to make things better. And that's all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The United States Constitution guarantees freedoms such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and freedom of religion. The Bill of Rights in the Constitution protects these and other individual rights. But the government has not always honored all of the rights in the Constitution. In the 1700s, for example, President John Adams supported laws to stop Thomas Jefferson and the Democratic Party from criticizing the government. During the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln took strong actions to prevent newspapers from printing military news. And during the 1950s, Senator Joseph McCarthy accused innocent people of being communists and traitors. Some of the most serious government attacks on personal rights took place in 1919 and 1920. A number of government officials took sometimes unlawful actions against labor leaders, foreigners, and others. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe discuss the campaign that came to be known as the Red Scare.
These actions took place because of American fears about the threat of communism. Those fears were tied closely to the growth of the organized labor movement during World War I. There were a number of strikes during the war. More and more often, workers were willing to risk their jobs and join together to try to improve working conditions. President Woodrow Wilson had long supported organized labor, and he tried to get workers and business owners to negotiate peacefully. But official support for organized labor ended when strikes closed factories that were important to the national war effort. President Wilson and his advisors felt workers should put the national interest before their private interest. They told workers to wait until after the war to demand more pay and better working conditions.
In general, American workers did wait. But when the war finally ended in 1918, American workers began to strike in large numbers for higher pay. As many as 2 million workers went on strike in 1919. There were strikes by house builders, meat cutters, and train operators. And there were strikes in the shipyards, the shoe factories, and the telephone companies. Most striking workers wanted the traditional goals of labor unions: more pay and shorter working hours. But a growing number of them also began to demand major changes in the economic system itself. They called for government control of certain private industries. Railroad workers, for example, wanted the national government to take permanent control of running the trains. Coal miners, too, demanded government control of their industry. And even in the conservative grain farming states, 200,000 farmers joined a group that called for major economic changes.
All these protests came as a shock to traditional Americans who considered their country to be the home of free business. They saw little need for labor unions, and they feared that the growing wave of strikes meant the United States faced the same revolution that had just taken place in Russia. After all, Lenin himself had warned that the Bolshevik Revolution would spread to workers in other countries. Several events in 1919 only increased this fear of violent revolution. A bomb exploded in the home of a senator from the southeastern state of Georgia. And someone even exploded a bomb in front of the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, the nation's chief law officer. However, the most frightening event was a strike by police in Boston, Massachusetts. The policemen demanded higher wages, but the police chief refused to negotiate with them. As a result, the policemen went on strike. When they did, thieves began to break into unprotected homes and shops. Massachusetts Governor Calvin Coolidge finally had to call out state troops to protect the people. His action defeated the strike. Most of the policemen lost their jobs.
All this was too much for many Americans. They began to accuse labor unions and others of planning a revolution. And they launched a forceful campaign to protect the country from these suspected extremists. Leaders of this campaign accused thousands of people of being communists or Reds. The campaign became known as the Red Scare. Of course, most people were honestly afraid of revolution. They did not trust the many foreigners who were active in unions, and they were tired of change and social unrest after the bloody World War. A number of these Americans in different cities began to take violent actions against people and groups that they suspected of being communist extremists. In New York, a crowd of men in military uniforms attacked the office of a socialist newspaper. They beat the people working there and destroyed the equipment. In the western city of Centralia, Washington, four people were killed in a violent fight between union members and their opponents. Public feeling was against the labor unions and political leftists. Many people considered anyone with leftist views to be a revolutionary trying to overthrow democracy. Many state and local governments passed laws making it a crime to belong to organizations that supported revolution. 28 states passed laws making it a crime to wave red flags.
People also demanded action from the national government. President Wilson was sick and unable to see the situation clearly. He cared about little except his dream of the United States joining the new League of Nations. But Attorney General Palmer heard the calls for action. Palmer hoped to be elected president the next year. He decided to take strong actions to gain the attention of voters. One of Palmer's first actions as Attorney General was to prevent coal miners from going on strike. Next, he ordered a series of raids to arrest leftist leaders. A number of these arrested people were innocent of any crime, but officials kept many of them in jail without charges for weeks. Palmer expelled from the country a number of foreigners suspected of revolutionary activity. He told reporters that communists were criminals who planned to overthrow everything that was good in life.
Feelings of fear and suspicion extended to other parts of American life. Many persons and groups were accused of supporting communism. Such famous Americans as actor Charlie Chaplin, educator John Dewey, and law professor Felix Frankfurter were among those accused. The Red Scare caused many innocent people to be afraid to express their ideas. They feared they might be accused of being a communist. But as quickly as the Red Scare swept across the country, so too did it end in 1920. In just a few months, people began to lose trust in Attorney General Palmer. They became tired of his extreme actions. Republican leader Charles Evans Hughes and other leading Americans called for the Justice Department to obey the law in arresting and charging people.
By the summer of 1920, the Red Scare was over. Even a large bomb explosion in New York in September did not change the opinion of most Americans that the nation should return to free speech and the rule of law. The Red Scare did not last long, but it was an important event. It showed that many Americans, after World War I, were tired of social changes. They wanted peace and business growth. Of course, the traditional way for Americans to show their feelings is through elections. And this growing conservatism of the nation showed itself clearly in the presidential election of 1920.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.